So here we are, Inform Podcast. This is the 25th episode overall, but it is the third episode of our second season where I am joined by my co-host, the Cat's Meow of the podcasting world. Jared, how are you?
Hey, meow, meow. How you doing, Neil?
I'm doing pretty good here. It's a weird day. Life in, is just now very strange, right? We're living in the times of COVID-19 and the end of human activity.
I don't even know what life is at this point anymore. I'm lost.
I'm with you, man. But hey, whatever. We're doing a podcast, so that's fun. That's good.
It's anchoring me.
Me too, actually. I've been looking forward to doing this today because the topic that we're going to be getting into is something that I think will be a lot of fun. It's another episode on the role of the analyst, and this time we're going to be talking about the role of the analyst and kind of casting the analyst, I guess, and the role of a detective. And I think that this will be really fun to talk about. Quick review. Last time we talked about the analyst as the role of the analyst as the secretary of the unconscious. You know, the unconscious shows up in the patient or the analyst's speech in different ways, and the secretary of the unconscious, you know, highlights different elements of what the unconscious might be saying in that speech and sort of gives it back to the subject, to the patient, and through that process does some interesting stuff. If you're interested in that, make sure you go back and listen to episode number 24. But today we're talking about the role of the analyst as a detective. A couple of sources that you might want to dive into at some point, maybe after listening to this, if you haven't already. The first is a paper by Freud that we'll be referencing, which is The Uncanny. That was written in 1917. The second one is a much longer text, a book by the late Mark Fisher, which was written almost 100 years. It was written 100 years later. Wow. Or published 100 years later.
Right.
In 2017, which is the text, The Weird and the Eerie. So I'm going to kick it over to you, Jared, since this is something that I think you've spent a lot of time thinking about and writing about and kind of doing things around. Why don't you kind of talk us through your introductory thoughts on the analyst as detective, what got you into this, and sure. Where are we going to go?
So actually, the route here has been sort of like two or maybe threefold. I'm not sure exactly. You have actually cited Mark Fisher's The Weird and the Eerie as being a really interesting book at several different points. So if you're stuck in quarantine and looking for a really, really good book to read, The Weird and the Eerie is outstanding. So that's the first place, that came up. Also, I'm reading through Jacques Lacan's Seminar 10 right now, and he has a section in there, and actually it comes up at several different points, where he references the Unheimlich, which is the uncanny. It's Freud's paper. So it's come up there as well. And then the two are connected by Freud's paper, The Uncanny. It's sort of the jumping off point for Mark Fisher. So actually, I'll go ahead and I'm starting all over the place, but I'm going to go ahead and hone in on The Uncanny instead first. And The Uncanny for Freud is sort of, it's an idea of what makes different experiences or things in our lives or relationships or something have sort of an odd quality to it, an unsettling quality that we can't quite place on any one thing, but it's sort of one of those things that we know it when we see it, or we know it when we don't see it, maybe, as we'll get to. His idea sort of boils down to maybe four or five different things. The first one is the idea of the double. Actually, Neil, can I kick that one over to you just for a quick second? Because I'm not sure that I have a super great grasp on it. So I'd prefer that you do that one and I'll do the other ones.
Sure, I can take a stab at it here. So Freud talks about this idea of the double. And my understanding of it is that originally he has this idea that human beings want to have a double, something that is a sort of recreation of themselves, that they find something comforting in that. And we can see this, you know, in a couple of different ways in human history and in what are, you know, air quotes, primitive cultures. So there's this idea that, you know, in Egypt, it was this idea maybe of Ka, of the soul. Of this sort of thing that is a double of you, that when your physical body dies, this double then kind of progresses into life in the underworld. And there's a bunch of other examples of it too, but that's a pretty good one, I think, to at least start to get a grasp of it, right? So there was this idea that there is you, the ego, and your ego, the I, the identity, has a double. And that double is a way that, according to Freud, if I'm reading him correctly anyways and understanding him correctly, that people kind of cope with annihilation anxiety, with death anxiety. Mm. With the fact that their physical, I mean, the knowledge that our physical body, our identity as a material entity is going to come to an end at some point. This is unavoidable. It's structural. It's baked into human experience. And that's very unsettling. Like, we don't like that. That might be an example maybe of what Lacan would call a touch of the real, you know, mm-hmm. in our lives. And as a result, there's this idea that we have a double and that double is, for lack of a better term, sort of a way out of this limitation, out of castration, out of the, it's a way to escape the real in a sense, right? Now, I think that this can become uncanny in two different ways. The first way is when people recognize that this idea of the double, the soul, the afterlife or whatever, that is perhaps not real, right? That is just a fantasy, that is a semblance. Of something. I think that realization that it's not quite maybe what we have been led to believe it is, that it's a mirage, that it's a fiction, that it's an illusion, that can unsettle people and shake them in a lot of different ways. That's one thing I think can happen with it. The other thing, and I think this is maybe more present in Freud's essay, I'm kind of curious if you think that this read makes sense to you, is the idea that the double might not be something that we control so much, right? Mm. That there is a double, and that there is some a part of us, maybe an unconscious element, and that part of ourselves is, you know, a double, but it's not a double that we necessarily have control over. It's a part of us that it is always outside of our grasp of control and influence and whatnot, and that can kind of scare people too. Anyways, yeah. So, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that reading makes a lot of sense. Freud's idea, if I'm reading it right, has a lot to do with narcissistic ego identification. And that's not necessarily something that we have a whole lot of conscious control over. It's something that maybe surprises us in more ways than we would like it to. So I think that reading makes a whole lot of sense to me.
So I mean to riff on that then a little bit here. You know, I have people who come in for analysis for psychotherapy, and what they usually come in with some form of a problem, or you could call it a symptom or a bunch of other things. And when they first come in, I think that they see that symptom, they see this problem, they see this way that they're behaving that is kind of messing up their life as this double, you know, something that is them, but also other than them. Mm. And that what they're looking for from the analytic experience or the psychotherapeutic experience is a way to kind of like regain control of that, or to cut it out of them and kind of get rid of it. And I think that the therapy that I do tends to introduce this idea of the uncanny. And it's this idea that, yes, this other part of you that is you, but also has a mind of its own, to kind of go back to something that we've talked about in the previous two podcasts. And my computer is making noises. Hold on, I'm going to close my email application here so that doesn't happen again. Anyway, so there's that, but you can't just like, you can't get control of that part of you. It's not going to happen. You're not going to, through this process or any other process for that matter, be able to kind of get the control of your unconscious. It's always going to be something that is you, but has a mind of its own. And you're also not going to be able to divorce it, right? You're not going to be able to kind of like get it out of your life and make it no longer a problem. That's not going to happen either. So, to say that in a maybe more succinct way, people come in and this uncanny thing has been asserting itself in their life in some way that they find problematic. They have a fantasy, I think, initially, of getting rid of it or besting it and kind of overpowering it in some way. And they think that the therapy will help them do that. And when they decide to stick with me, a lot of times what happens is they start to divest themselves from that fantasy, and they start to accept that this unconscious part of themselves that has a mind of its own is there for better or for worse, right? It's a part of their life, whether they like it or not. And we start talking in that direction, right? So what are you going to do with that? How are you going to, how are you going to live if that is the case?
Right. Yeah. It's more about changing your relationship to it rather than trying to sever it.
Indeed.
If,
yeah.
If that makes sense. Yeah, for sure. No, I agree with that 100%. It makes a whole lot of sense to me right now. We're on the same wavelength here. So then the rest of Freud's uncanny, then, to move on from the double, first, the first one that he talks about besides the double is animism, when things that are otherwise have no consciousness to them, no life to them, like a doll or like a stuffed animal or something like that, something that has nothing. I'm looking at a bunch of stuffed animals, so there's children's toys are coming to mind very easily right now. But they're good examples. They're things that you wouldn't expect to have any sort of aspect like that to them. But then when they do, or when they appear to, or in literature and things like that, it sort of gives us another sense of the uncanny. You look like you want to say something, Neil.
There's an example, I think, of this that kind of comes to mind. You see it sometimes in films, I think. I can't think of a specific film off the top of my head, but there's a couple and they start to, you know, make out or whatever. And there's like a picture in the room, and maybe it's like a picture of somebody's like grandmother or their mother or their dead partner who, or something like that. And then you'll see them kind of like take the picture and put it face down so that the picture is no longer like, you know, looking at them making out with this, right, this person. That's what I was thinking of when I read about this idea of animism, right? Because it's a picture. It's not real. It doesn't see anything. But the person, right, when they're doing this, there's this like weirdness, this oddness, because this object is there. And in an attempt to kind of like evacuate that weirdness, that oddness, that feeling of unsettling, they put the picture face down. Maybe that works. Maybe it doesn't. In either case, the feeling of weirdness isn't coming from the picture, right? It's coming from inside the subject themselves, and they're projecting that onto the picture. That's what they're experiencing. It's a very interesting thing, because it is this kind of process by which a person attributes the ability to see, you know, in this case, which is a human characteristic, onto a non-human object. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think that's actually a really interesting thing, and I could say more about it, but that's my example of animism that came to my mind when I read it.
Another one that comes to mind as you put it like that is the painting whose eyes follow you wherever you're standing in the room. And that works in a similar way. Obviously its eyes aren't actually following you. They're painted in such a way that as you look at it, you get that illusion, and it's kind of weird to look at a painting and stand at various parts in a room and feel like it's still staring at you.
Yeah, it's interesting. And in both of these examples we're giving, these seem like examples of the gaze in a sense.
They do a little bit. Yeah, I'm trying my best not to steer too hard into that, because that seems like a totally different topic. Probably related, but totally separate. Mm-hmm. So then after animism, there's also the castration complex. The phantasmatic reminder that that everyone is castrated, that we are castrated, that everybody that we previously thought was not castrated is actually castrated, when we are reminded of that fact, because, you know, in a lot of ways we have license to act as if we're not, or maybe prior to analysis or during during it, but before you have come to reconcile with it, the way that you were talking about just a few minutes ago, when we are reminded of the fact that we are in fact castrated, that we're not going to, you know, do all the things that we thought we were going to do, when we realize that we're not Superman or whatever it is, that brings a register of the uncanny to it as well. You look like you're going to say something again too.
Yeah. Well, I think it's important just for the uninitiated here to call our attention to two things. Like when you say castration, you do not mean literal physical castration, as in
No. A
part of the body being cut away. You're talking about castration.
That's a serious misreading of Freud, I think.
Totally, yeah. You're talking about symbolic castration, right?
Right, exactly.
So the idea there is that, you know, for a portion of our lives, we have this idea that we can do things that we just can't do, right? Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, and probably several points, we are made very much more aware of the fact that we are limited, that there are things that we want to do and we might be able to try to do them, but we probably won't be able to do them. Mm. And this is what castration is, right? And it also kind of follows from there. A lot of times when people accept castration of themselves, they then kind of lean into a new fantasy, and it's a fantasy of the non-castrated other.
Yeah. Actually, I had a really good idea of an example of that one as I was thinking about this. I had a friend who's a huge basketball fan. He's been a basketball fan for ever and ever and ever and ever. And his favorite player is Kobe Bryant. And Kobe Bryant was in the NBA for a really long time. He was an outstanding player in the Hall of Fame, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, like maybe within the last 5 years, he was injured, came back and was never the same. And for my friend, watching him try to play again and not being the same Kobe Bryant that he was in like 2002, he could barely even watch basketball anymore. He couldn't do it. He felt way too like, whoa, this is not the same thing anymore. I can't do this at all.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think of it a lot of times. I mean, you see this with kids. I was just talking to somebody about this before we did this call. I had a call with a student who was asking me some questions about psychological theory because they're writing a paper. And one of the things they were asking me about was this, right? This thing that we're talking about. And the way I was trying to explain it is that, you know, kids for a while believe that they can do anything, and then it becomes clear to the kid somehow that they can't do everything they want to do. At that point, the kid kind of then assumes, well, if I can't do everything I want to do, my mom and my dad can do everything they want to do. And that's a fantasy that the kid has. The fantasy of the non-castrated other is put onto the parent. And the kid believes that the parent can buy them whatever they want, can provide them with anything that they need. And kids do that because having that fantasy lets you feel safe and secure in the world. It's kind of nice. It's kind of enjoyable. And then eventually, you know, even later on, it becomes clear that your parents are also castrated, right? And then I think what happens after that is the idea of the non-castrated other for many people just slides on to the next thing. For some people, that might be God. That might be the church. That might be society or whatever, their country, et cetera, right?
Right.
But it's just this idea still of a non-castrated other. And again, this is all symbolic, right? It has to do with the ability to do what you want to do.
Right.
Ultimately. The other thing that you brought up with this, though, too, is the concept of phantasmatic. And that's another thing that I think, you know, if people aren't well-read, you know, in psychoanalytic theory and Lacan, they might not have a good idea of what that particular word means. So I was going to see if you wanted to kind of jump in and say a little bit more about phantasmatic and what that means.
Sure. I mean, when I come across that word as I'm reading, or if I write it down while I'm writing something, I usually mean something along the lines of the fact that it is, whatever the concept is that I'm wrestling with stems from a fantasy. It's not, I can't remember exactly how I said it when I was talking. So you might have to remind me, but it's always, for me, that means that it's coming back to a fantasy. It's not a, material objective reality that whatever it is producing this thing, this concept. Again, I wish I could remember exactly what I said, but I can't. But instead of being reproduced from some objective material reality, it's stemming from a fantasy instead.
That, I think that's good enough. That makes sense, right? So yeah, phantasmatic is spelled with a PH, and it's weird. It's kind of like a combination, I think, of like phantom and fantasy sort of together. In a weird way, but it's this idea, I think, that people do have a fantasy, and that fantasy oftentimes is the fantasy of the non-castrated other.
Right? Yeah, for sure.
This thing out there in the world, and as long as some people will rebel against it, you know, and that'll be what they dedicate their lives to, is rebellion to this non-castrated other, and other people will attempt to, I think, dedicate their lives in conforming to it and trying to, like, please it in some way, shape, or form and get it to like them. So on and so forth. But yeah, all of this is based on something that isn't real, right? It's a phantasm, a fantasy of this other in that way.
Right. Yeah, for sure. That's, I think we're on the same wavelength here about that one. The next one after animism, castration complex is repetition compulsion. And actually in The Uncanny, Freud doesn't, the paper, The Uncanny, I should say, Freud doesn't go into a lot of detail in it. Instead, basically what he does is give a really rough sketch of his idea of repetition compulsion and then refer you to to another work of his, Beyond the Pleasure Principle, where he's been going over what the repetition compulsion is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
And then, oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were going to say something.
you cut out there for a second. I was just gonna tell you that, but I think we caught the majority of what you were trying to say.
Okay. Cool. Well, then I'm gonna try my best to go through it in a little bit of detail here. So Freud gives this example of actually himself. He's walking around a city that he's, or at least a part of the city. I can't remember if it's a new city or just one that he's not super familiar with the area. But either way, he's wandering around, trying to find his way to the train station or something like that, and he can't find it. And he's deliberately trying to take different routes so that he can eventually like make his way to the train station by going in different directions. But instead, he finds himself back at the same crossroad. Over and over and over and over and over again. And that strikes him as odd, as I think it would probably strike anybody. He gives a similar example of being in a wandering around like a misty forest where you are trying to find your way out, but instead you keep finding yourself. I think this is more common in film and literature, where you're walking around some sort of forest and then you accidentally find like the same clump of moss on a tree or something like that, or a familiar looking rock. And you're like in the films that are like, what the hell? We were just at this exact rock. Where the hell are we going? And that for Freud possesses a sense of the uncanny. And he expands this out into the like behavior of the patients that he sees in his clinic, where he finds them not literally walking around the same exact path, but sort of mentally, unconsciously walking through the same paths over and over and over again and finding themselves in the same situations every single time without fail.
Yeah, this is where I think the what we were going to get into today kind of is a good place to interject it, right? The idea of the analyst or the therapist as a detective,
mm-hmm.
right? So this idea here of repetition compulsion could be understood as a mystery. If somebody keeps on doing something, they find themselves going through something, and they've set out not to, right? Like, I mean,
right.
they don't want to. They come in saying, I keep on finding myself in the same sort of pattern with romantic relationships or with jobs or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like this. Like, this is, I start seeing somebody, it turns out they're an alcoholic, that it's terrible. And we break up, I'm hurt, you know, and stuff like that. And then, you know, I meet somebody else and then they're an alcoholic too. And then the third time I was just like, I'm not dating an alcoholic. And so I met somebody and I was like, you better not be an alcoholic. And then it turns out, you know what? It turns out they were an alcoholic. And it's like, well, where did you meet this person? At an AA meeting, you know, and you see people sort of like, despite their efforts, right, to do otherwise, they keep on engaging in something. They keep on doing this thing over and over and over and over and over again. And it's actually not something that they're consciously enjoying.
Right.
There's an unconscious potential enjoyment in it. And through being a detective, what you might be able to do is sort of like team up with this person. And I think I'm kind of making them as I go along here. The analyst would be kind of like the Sherlock Holmes, and the analysand would be more like the Watson, right?
Sure.
And they'd sort of like team up together to try to understand more about this mystery.
Yeah.
Now, Sherlock Holmes, the Sherlock Holmes detective character, is somebody who notices things that most people mm-hmm. don't notice. And by noticing them and calling people's attention to them, he is able to kind of elucidate the reasons why something has gone down. This is similar to the idea of the analyst here as a secretary, you know, and detective. Both of them notice different things that might be emanating from the unconscious,
right?
Call attention to them, and then use those things to some sort of an effect, right? One of the things that I think is really important to think about here for clinical work, though, is something that I think needs to happen in analysis if it's going to be effective. And that is the transition from demand to desire.
Mm.
When the patient first comes in, They don't come in saying, help me solve this mystery. I'm curious about why I keep doing this thing that I keep
doing.
They
never do that, no.
They come in and they have a demand. The demand is, I keep on doing this thing, make me stop doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Or some version of that. That's a demand, right? That is not a desire to understand it. That is not a desire to kind of like try to figure out to solve the mystery. It's just that's trying to cut out the unconscious. That's trying to divorce the unconscious. That's trying to overpower the unconscious. That's the demand. And that's not going to happen. You're never going to do those things. The unconscious is part of your life. It's part of you that has a mind of its own, for better and for worse. And it's going to be there. And so when you move from demand, get rid of this, to desire, the desire is always a question of like, well, okay, if this is a part of my life, how am I going to live with this? What am I going to do with this? How can I live with it under these conditions that I'm in, enjoying the things that I enjoy, seeking the things that I seek, et cetera, right? If the person starts having more questions, like, why do I do these things? It's really interesting, isn't it? Like, I mean, you'd think I wouldn't do it, but I keep on doing it. There's got to be some reason that I keep... If they move to that, now you're doing analysis. Now something is happening, right? I think of that as a really essential characteristic of the analytic process. And I think that's just the way it's got to be, right? If somebody's coming in with a demand, I don't know that you're going to be able to start doing analytic work. You have to transition to desire to start doing analytic work.
And it's, I think that's, it's important to bring up that when you're trying to become a psychoanalyst, I don't think it really matters what route you take to trying to be one, whether you're going for Freudian psychoanalysis or you want to be a Lacanian psychoanalyst or in some other form of psychoanalysis, whatever form it takes, it's almost always, as far as I know, important that you take part in your own analysis. You have to. I think that's paramount. It's absolutely essential. There's no way to really understand it or explain it or try to help other people traverse that transition from demand to desire without having undergone it yourself. It's imperative. There's no way to get around it.
It's funny that you say that. So here, this is a confession, right? So when I started doing my own analysis, right, for real, like I found an analyst and it was a Lacanian analyst, and I went to him and I said, I want to do analysis. The question he has for me is, why? Why do you want to do this? It's just a perfectly reasonable and understandable question. And I said, because I want to be an analyst, right? Which is funny because I was demanding something in that.
Yeah.
Okay. That was me not ready to do the analytic work at that moment. My demand was authorize me to be an analyst.
I was going to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do the thing that will make me into an analyst. I have to meet this requirement. So help me meet it.
Totally. You know, and that was my thing going in there. And I think that's not uncommon. A lot of people go to analysis with that particular demand. It's, I think, fairly normal, right? And I mean, kind of skipping a lot of stuff here, eventually, instead of going in and being like, do this thing to make me an analyst, I started to ask, like, why do I even want to do that? Like, why do I want to be an analyst? What is it about that I find appealing? Why invest the time, the energy, the anxiety, the experience, you know, et cetera, into this kind of, you know, extremely time-consuming and rather expensive process?
Right.
You know, it's not, I'm not doing this, and it is hard in a number of different ways. It's hard from an emotional perspective. It's hard from a financial perspective. It requires a great deal of time and commitment, et cetera. So if I'm going to air quote suffer through all of those things, why? You know, that becomes an interesting question then. Why do you want to do this? And I mean, that leads in a bunch of different directions, you know, for me.
For sure.
You know, there was a bunch of other desires kind of tied up in that desire, ultimately. And the analytic process, when once I transitioned from tell me that I've done enough analysis to consider myself analyzed and available to start to become an analyst myself, to questions about like, well, why do I want to be an analyst? What sort of analyst do I want to be? Why am I doing this, et cetera? Then I was starting to do analytic work. There was a mystery that I was attempting to solve, right? In that. And the mystery also incidentally turned into, well, what's stopping you from being an analyst now? You know, like, why do you think you need to go through whatever you think you need to go through in order to arrive? Because part of the thing that makes Lacanians different, I'd say, than other psychoanalysts is the extreme importance of self-authorization.
Right.
To the Lacanian analyst, the formation of the analyst. You can go, for example, and present yourself to a psychoanalytic institute and do all sorts of different coursework for a bunch of years, and you can go see an analyst four times a week for however long, and you can do all sorts of different supervision. And, you know, if all those people, if your supervisor and your analyst and your institute all say, okay, cool, you're done now, you're an analyst, but you don't feel that you're an analyst, like you're not buying into that idea, it really doesn't matter that much.
No. Then you're not going to do very good work if you try to.
You know, maybe you will, though. I don't know if somebody would or wouldn't.
Who knows?
Yeah. But the key thing here is that Lacan's saying that, I mean, there's in the Lacanian world, you can, you know, get different things. Like you can become an analyst of the school. You can do something called a pass where you mm-hmm. talk about your own analysis and then people recognize you as somebody who's done that. Like, so there's like levels and stuff in the Lacanian world. There are titles that you can earn. But the idea here is that earning those titles is not the thing that makes you an analyst. Mm-hmm. There are things that are nice, they're enjoyable, but maybe you even derive a sense of accomplishment from doing them. But the thing that makes you an analyst is your belief that you are an analyst, whatever that means, right? And I mean, sometimes when I say this, people think like all that people have to do is think that they're an analyst. And it's like, yes, in a way, but also no, because... that sounds easy, but it's actually significantly more difficult than you might realize, right?
Like, absolutely.
I mean, I still see myself at this point as an analyst very much in formation, and I don't know if I'll ever think that I'm done forming. I hope that I'm not. I never think that I'm done forming as an analyst. I'm always learning new stuff and whatnot. And that's really interesting to me, right? So I feel as though I am an analyst in formation, and that I will be an analyst in formation for a really long time. I might do some other things too, but I do feel, to a degree anyways, exactly how much I can't say, authorized to do this thing, this practice of analysis. And I, right. I will tell people that I can do that. You want to do analysis? You want to do it with me? Let's give it a try. Let's see how it goes. Mm. And I feel justified in doing that. You know, I didn't always feel that way. I feel that way today, but it took a while to get there.
I'm getting my own sense of the uncanny here, because I actually about a week ago had a very similar conversation like this with somebody who completely disagreed with the notion that you authorize yourself in any way. Like they were very hardline, this person, that you have to do all of the four times a week for 3 years and see this many patients. And like, it's very strange. And I didn't expect that to come up during this episode, but here it is.
Yeah. You know, this is one of the other things. I mean, it, as many times as will happen when we talk, I think it'll turn into like a commercial for Lacan, but, Lacanians, one of the main attractions for me to the Lacanian world is that they have sort of a reverence for rules. Right, like the things that you just mentioned are rules, and you have to go see a analyst four times a week for 3 years, and you have to go through so many patients where you have a supervisor. Those are rules, and Lacan didn't have much use for those. I think he was more interested in principles. Right, principles are what guide you, not rules. Mm-hmm. So a principle is this idea of transitioning from demand to desire. That's a principle. It's not a rule, right? Like, because there's not any specific way that one person might do that. Everybody's kind of different. And
right.
So you can follow the principle. You can use the principle in a way which I believe is more interesting and effective than you can use a rule.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. It's a lot more flexible in that way too. A principle is a lot more... easily adapted to various different situations that you might encounter in the clinic, or even, I mean, Lacan's theories get used culturally as well. Freud's do too, but I think I've seen Lacan a little bit more widely than Freud. I don't know. Maybe that's wrong. Maybe that's just because I like to read a lot of Lacan. So maybe I'm off here. But thinking of it as a principle, I do still very firmly believe leaves you a lot more flexibility to use whatever the principle is in myriad different ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, you bring up the thing about Freud and Lacan. I think this is actually maybe a way to kind of sort of segue back into some of the things that we plan to talk about here. So, you know, Freud was of a certain...
We have gotten off the track.
But that's fine. I mean, it's interesting to have a plan because, you know, interesting things come when you go off point, right?
Right.
And all that. We could digress further, but I'm going to not do that at this moment. You know, Freud was a person who was, you know, living, working, thinking at a specific moment in time. And that moment in time is different than the time that we're contained in today. Freud didn't have the internet. He didn't have airplanes. There's so much stuff that were not a part of his everyday life. It was different. And so I think that he wrote in ways and used concepts that seem sometimes as though they are of a different era. Right. And can you still use them in the contemporary era? Yeah, you can, but they still have that feel, you know what I mean? Of this different time of a time that is gone at this point. Now, Lacan is a little bit more of this era, I think. Right. I mean, he died I can't remember if it was 80 or 81. Yeah. So, you know, it's closer to us at this point. And so I think that maybe makes his thinking kind of like slot into some of our contemporary situations somewhat more smoothly than some of the Freudian ideas. But the Freudian ideas are still really useful and very powerful, I think. So we were going to talk, though, about making a comparison between, you know, Freud and the way that he talks about the uncanny and this sort of like the way that the uncanny asserts itself in our lives and sort of freaks us out, and Mark Fisher, who is somebody who is extremely contemporary, right? So Mark Fisher died in 2017. And in that same year, there was a book that was published. I don't remember if it was published before or after he died, but it was called The Weird and the Eerie. And I think you're trying to take kind of Freud's ideas of the uncanny and Fisher's ideas of the weird and the eerie and do sort of like a weaving them together in some way. So why don't you talk about that?
Yeah. So, you know, Freud was... First and foremost, he was a clinician, and Mark Fisher. I don't know if we can say this for sure. I don't know if there's any source of information that says it for sure. And I think he was probably someone who went through analysis, just given the way that he writes and thinks about it and brings it into his books. But he wasn't a clinician, so what I did as I was reading the Weird and the Eerie. Is I thought to myself, you know, Freud, the idea of the uncanny is an idea that came from someone who was at his core a clinician, and Mark Fisher has taken his idea of the uncanny and applied it to literature, film, music, a couple other things in this book. So it leads me to believe that there must be some sort of clinical ideas that can come from it. I think we end up finding clinical ideas in things that we would not expect them to find them in. So this is my way of saying to read other stuff besides strictly like clinical articles and books and stuff like that, because you'll find it in a lot of different and surprising places. So Mark Fisher takes the idea of the uncanny, and he comes up with two related, very closely related, but also distinct ideas of the weird and the eerie. The weird for Mark Fisher is when there's something present that doesn't seem to quite fit. It seems like from a different world, or maybe from a different time, or maybe both. But here it is, right here, right now. The first example that he gives is H.P. Lovecraft, who I think is... I haven't read like every single thing that he's ever written, but I have read three or four of his short stories, and they give you a really unsettling feeling as you read them. And it's not because he describes them in a way that is like more akin to the horror genre, where you watch like some gore film or something, and that strikes you as like, it sort of gives you a bleh kind of feeling, like, ugh, that's disgusting and gross, and it's weird in a different way. I think the way that Lovecraft writes about the weird is, well, I mean, Mark Fisher thinks that the way that H.P. Lovecraft brings about the weird is because they seem foreign the creatures that he talks about seem like they should not be here, but we find them here. And they're among people that are just typical, normal people. Sometimes they're scientists, sometimes they're geologists or other different various things. I'm really stuck on the Mountains of Madness right now. So those are what's coming to mind off the top of my head. But they're just people. They're just normal people, and they go to a place that exists on Earth, and then they find something totally alien to Earth.
This makes me think of the unconscious, actually, again, and the drive, for that matter. Like, I don't know if I'm right to do this or not, but I kind of think of the way that I read Lovecraft, or the way that I understand Lovecraft, and a lot of other kind of like monster fiction and monster movies and stuff. The reason that those things kind of have the pull and the appeal that they do culturally is because inside of us, inside of everything, you, me, and all the people we know and all the people we don't know, there are monsters, right? Mm-hmm. And I think of the monsters kind of, I equate them with the drive a lot of times. We all have drives. We all have monsters inside us. And under certain conditions, you know, like if you're a werewolf, under the full moon is the condition. But that's just a metaphor for life, right? What is the full moon in our lives that under the right conditions, the drive comes out and starts being extremely mm-hmm. destructive? It destroys our relationships. It destroys our careers. It destroys our bodies, et cetera, right? I really think that's why that stuff is there. The other cool thing about like the Lovecraft stuff is that it like you said, it kind of gets at this idea that there are things, they're there, and they're kind of like exerting an influence on the world, and we can't stop it, right? There's no way to prevent the influence of these things that are there but have a mind of their own and are kind of different than our own minds, right? Like I find that to be sort of a useful way of thinking again about the unconscious and about the drive in particular.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense, especially I sort of disparage myself for only thinking of the Mountains of Madness. But since you put it that way, I think the Mountains of Madness are actually a really good depiction of what you're saying, because the scientists that survive the attacks from the monsters end up sort of walking through this immense, like unimaginably immense labyrinth, and they keep on accidentally finding things that they probably weren't supposed to find. They were supposed to stay hidden, and they just keep on finding. Like they find the sled with the dogs that are all dead that they probably weren't supposed to see, and they find like hieroglyphics sort of all over the place, and then eventually they end up finding some of the monsters nearer the like the center of the cave, and they. It's just, I think, a really good way to bring in the unconscious here, because the way that I think about the unconscious, like when I try to picture it, is often as a labyrinth, as some sort of maze. Mm. So I don't know. That's what came to mind as you were talking about the unconscious.
I think that kind of calls to mind a different idea for me here. And it's to say, so if we think of the unconscious as the repository of all of our repressed desires, I think of the in Lovecraft, the elder gods, you know, it's sort of those repressed unconscious desires. They're things that are so terrifying and weird and disconcerting that we can't have them be a part of our lives and be okay with that. So we have to, they become repressed. They go to the unconscious, this other place where they do continue to exist. It's just as it's we can kind of act as if they didn't, but they are there. And they are these unconscious desires, i.e. the elder gods, are out of sight and people are unaware of them, but they're continuing to push and pull and exert influence in different ways. And we see this. Again, I know I'm harping on this point, but I think it's so important to think of the unconscious as this part of us. It is part of us. It is not mm-hmm. something else. It is part of us, and it does have a mind of its own. And that isn't a good way to think about it. Again, like I think of the monsters a lot of times more associated with the drive than the unconscious, but the idea of these things being repressed because they are unacceptable fits kind of like with the mm-hmm. idea of the unconscious as place in a way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, that makes a lot of sense. You actually, you made a note here under the weird. It's sort of a subheading here under the weird that says the symptom. I'm curious to know what you're thinking there.
Okay, so let me bounce over to my notes real quick here. So the way that Fisher talks about the weird and the eerie, I was kind of, when I was getting ready for this episode, I was thinking about that, and I was trying to be like, okay, so what's the difference between these two things? Like, he talks about the weird as one thing, and he talks about the eerie very much as a different phenomenon, different thing. So the way I understand the weird is that it is the presence of something in our lives that we don't expect, that does not fit, right? Mm-hmm. So it's something is there, and it's like, it's what's that doing there? That's weird. Why is that there? So like, if you, I don't know, you go to your pantry, right? Because you're going to get something out of your pantry, and you open your pantry, and in the pantry you find like something that wouldn't normally be there. That'd be weird. So like, I don't know, if I found, that would be a good example of this. If I found a chair in our pantry, that'd be odd. Like, well, who put a chair in here? You know? Now you might think that it was somebody trying to reach something up high. Like it kicks you off and goes like, what is this doing here? It doesn't belong here, but it is here. So something put it here. What is, you know, it does that, right? That's what the weird does. It's this, something is here. I don't know why it's here. It doesn't make total sense why it's here, but I want to figure something out now. Right. It's this thing that activates our desire to sort of know more about whatever. I think that it's very much triggered by the presence of something. There's something here that doesn't belong. How did it get here? You know, the presence of this unexpected thing has the effect. The effect is that it makes us kind of go like, the hell? The way that Fisher writes about the weird, it wouldn't be like a chair in the pantry. That's somewhat mundane. I think for Fisher, it would be more like there's a bloody butcher knife, you know, in the pantry, and it'd be like, whoa, wait, what the hell is this? Or like a pig's heart or something like that. That would be his example of it. It would be a little bit more bombastic and extreme and horrific. Yeah. But again, it would be like, what is this doing here? It is the idea. So I think that this kind of maps potentially onto the idea of a symptom. You know, the thinking of the symptom is something that a person does. And they're like, wait a minute, why did I do that? That's weird. And the symptom could be something simple. It could be like a slip or whatever. You know, somebody says my sister when they mean my wife, or they say, you know, my son when they mean their father or whatever. It could be that the person forgets something that's seemingly very important to them. Then there's a really negative effect of them forgetting it, and they had it on their calendar, and they reminded themselves, and they set an alarm and whatever, and it still didn't work. Like, these are things that are weird. They're examples, I think, of things happening, things that people do. And I'm considering like forgetting a doing in this case, which is maybe odd, but that's it. So that's the way that I think of it. And I think this contrasts very strongly with the eerie, because I think of the eerie, and I don't know, I think maybe you have a different read on this. I'm not quite sure. But I think of the eerie as something which is an absence, right? You expect something to be there and it's not there. It's missing. So I associate the weird with the symptom, I associate the eerie with the gap, right? With it's like there's something, there's this weird gap where there's nothing, and then, oh, there's something again. That to me is the eerie. Like if somebody comes in, they might come in sort of with like a symptom of some sort, right? And you can like they say I keep on making the same mistake, and they tell you about the most recent time when they made a mistake. That's the weird. As they tell you about it, there might be like a gap, right? So like on Monday I did this, on Tuesday I did this, on Thursday I did this, and now there's this big weird gap at Wednesday. That's weird. That's not weird. That's the eerie right there. That gap, that missing section of time. What happened there? And you want to try to figure that out. So in a sense, they can go together, but I think that they're different in that way. So yeah, I don't know if that makes any sense to you as I say it, or if you agree or disagree or whatever.
No, it does. The way that you're thinking about the weird as the symptom, I think lines up really nicely with I don't think we've actually mentioned this yet, but I just for fun, not for any school work or professional thing. Just I wrote a paper on this topic, and my contention in there is that the weird acts as sort of a signpost of the unconscious. And I think that basically maps almost directly on top of your idea here of the symptom. But then my idea of the eerie is that it's sort of the form of the unconscious as given direction by the weird, which probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So let me try to back it up a little bit and say, first of all, that I think our ideas are complementary but different here, because the way that I think about the eerie has a lot to do with agency, finding agency where we don't expect to find any agency, or not finding agency where we do expect to find agency. So in your clinical example, say, you know, take the example of somebody who accidentally find themselves in a relationship with an addict, like over and over again. The weird is when they make a conscious effort to say, I'm going to vet every single person that I meet. I'm going to, ask to see their 15-year AA chip, and I'm going to do all of these different things to make sure that I don't end up with an addict. And then they end up with an addict anyway. That, to me, indicates something that's weird. That's like, what the hell? I was really trying hard not to do this, but here I am doing it again. For me, then, the eerie is the point when that person realizes that they are implicated in the process of accidentally, quote, big scary air quotes, accidentally finding themselves in this relationship over and over and over again, at a place where they expected to find no agency. They thought it was accidental because, you know, I was trying not to do it, but it happened anyway. It was an accident. Instead of finding nothing at that place, they find an agency, and it is them. And that, for me, is what makes the eerie.
That is an interesting way of looking at it. Like I think I do look at it very differently. I almost imagine the weird kind of going along with certain Freudian ideas like condensation and displacement and those sorts of things. I think of it as an injection. There's something that gets put in, added, that makes things wrong, right? So it's like if we imagine there's a recipe, right, and the recipe calls for whatever things, and then somebody adds something different to it, and it makes the whatever is produced, whatever food is cooked or baked or whatever, taste off, right? That ingredient is the weird thing, and it creates this weird taste. It creates this weird experience. You think you're going to eat cake, and it tastes salty, and you're like, "What the hell? You know, that's weird." That would be the weird for me, where I think of the eerie as like a redaction. It's like you're reading a document, and they put those big black bars through different parts of it. That's the eerie. Like what? There should be something there, and I want to know what it is. And I don't know what it is. It's missing. It was there and now it's not. That is eerie. I think of, to use a different example, like the idea of going to a town and having it be like abandoned, you expect to see like people and stuff like that. That would be eerie. Weird, on the other hand, is you go to a town, you know, expecting to not see anybody who you know, because you're like, you know, taking a vacation just with yourself to get away from everything. And all of a sudden you see somebody who like is your next door neighbor, you know, on the street, and they nod to you. That would be weird, right? That's an insertion of something. So I think that they're both interesting, and they're both ways to start to talk about the presence of the unconscious. They're both different ways to start a mystery where the analyst can perform their Sherlock Holmes kind of like detective thing and try to figure out like, well, what has been redacted, what has been removed, what has been taken out here, and or, well, why is that person there? What's up with that? That's different. But they're both starts to the process of desire, to the you know, why is this person here? Why is that weird thing present? Or, well, what was there that is no longer there? What has been removed? What has been redacted? What has been taken away? What has been put into the gap? Both of them are those different ways and stuff. But I think that the cool thing about this conversation, for me anyways, is that it does illustrate that we can have very different readings of these concepts and make use of them in different ways that we both find kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, in this piece that I wrote, that's sort of my whole concluding point, is that the way that you read it is, honestly, it's hardly the important part. The important thing is that it does something interesting for you, that it moves you in some way, consciously or unconsciously. I think probably preferably unconsciously, but if it does something for you that allows you a new way to consider the speech of your patients, then I think it's done its job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, these are both concepts that you can deploy in different ways, definitely. I think that another way that sometimes I think about this, right? And I'm thinking about this sort of for the first time, I think, anyways, as we're talking about it. I'm kind of trying to use the other in this. So the weird is where there's too much of the big O other, right? It's the gaze. Mm-hmm. It's this feeling something present that you are like, wait a minute, like I didn't think anybody was watching me, but I'm being watched. That's weird, right? It's the other makes its presence felt and asserted in some kind of unexpected way that leaves you shaken. Where I think of the eerie a lot of times is almost like the gap, right? You expect the other to be there and it's not, in a way. And I think both of these things are disconcerting, right? They make a person feel the uncanny. They make a person feel weird. They make I shouldn't use the word weird. They make a person feel unsettled.
Off. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. But it in either case, though, the sort of like the valence of it is not the same thing. I think for me, you know, in my way of trying to understand this, the weird is always like predicated on the presence of the other, too much other. And I think that the eerie is predicated on the lack, the other being gone missing in some way, shape, or form.
Let me ask you, when you put it that way, I wonder if in the way that you think about it, the place where you expect to find the other and instead find the other lacking, do you instead find subject there?
You could, I suppose, but okay. I guess like maybe to kind of go to something we were talking about in the beginning when we started talking about castration, right? The idea of the non-castrated other is something that a lot of people I think have. And the idea that the other is castrated is eerie, right? You think that the other has... is non-castrated, that the other has the capacity, the power, the ability to keep you safe and secure and keep life regulated and organized, right? So now we just have this, the coronavirus. The coronavirus, I think, illustrates to a pretty excessive degree the extent to which the other is not non-castrated.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The other is castrated. And that for some people, it's like you expected that the other in the form of like governments or science or whatever would be able to manage this situation and stop it from spiraling out of control and keep the economies of the world on track and, you know, make it so that you don't have to wait in line when you go to the grocery store and so on and so forth. But now, you know, you're seeing people like the store only lets 30 people in at a time and everybody's wearing masks and gloves or whatever. This is that is weird, right? The weirdness is the presence of the masks and the gloves and all these things. That's not normal. That's different. That's weird. The eerie component of it is, well, what's missing here is the sense of security and safety that people felt when they believed in the kind of like power of the non-castrated other. That's gone. Mm. It's not there. And that's shaking you up in a different way, right? But They're different things. One's a presence, one is an absence, but they both kind of like get into the subject and make the subject extremely aware of its status as a subject, as a lacking being, as a somebody who is not able to be as safe and secure as they want to be, right? Mm-hmm. That's missing. Now, most of the time we don't go through life consciously thinking about just how much is missing and how insecure we are. And these are two things that kind of like somehow bring that up for the subject, right? So they make the subject aware that the subject is a subject, but I don't know if that's what you were getting at when you asked your question.
Maybe that's not the way that I said it, but I do think that was the question that I was trying to ask. Like it reaffirms the bar in the barred S.
Yeah, I think. Yeah,
yeah.
The subject might if the okay, so if the subject is barred, if the subject is limited, then there's this idea that there's something else that is not. And as long as that other thing is not, then I'll be all right as long as I'm able to kind of keep it in view, right? Mm-hmm. Well, the eerie is this idea that, oh, wait a minute, it's gone out of view. I can't see it anymore, right? If you're using the lighthouse to navigate and to kind of know where the shore is, and then all of a sudden the light goes out, that's eerie. That's you're missing something that you relied on to make yourself feel oriented in the world, and now it's not there. That's eerie. A weird thing would be like if all of a sudden, like, you know, a new light kind of popped up somewhere and started, like, I don't know, flashing the SOS thing like that. That's weird. Who's out here or whatever. Both things might make you kind of go like, huh, but they aren't the same thing.
Huh. That's a cool way of thinking about it. Yeah. We do definitely have different readings of this whole thing, but either way, the thing about either way of thinking about it, I think I'm accidentally demonstrating right now, is that I find your take totally fascinating. It's such a cool way to think about this, this idea of Mark Fisher's The Weird and the Eerie. And I don't know, I'm going to keep thinking about it a bunch more when we're done here too. It's not going to leave me alone for a little while.
Yeah, you know, it's another thing that I think is kind of interesting in the piece that you wrote that I kind of wanted to come back to here is something that I think can get introduced into the clinical experience, the way that the weird and the eerie might kind of be introduced there. I think that sometimes what people start to realize is that whether something is weird or eerie, they can become aware of this idea that there is more to life, more to themselves, more to things than they thought there was, right? Like, I think a lot of times people come into therapy sort of looking for an analyst or for a therapist to kind of shore up their identity, just to perform this function of the non-castrated other, to be somebody who stands in for, as a semblant of, the non-castrated other. And I think what I do a lot of times with people is I don't play that role, right? Like I play a different role. Instead of playing the role of the knowledgeable therapist, doctor person who can cure them, I play the role of the analyst, who is more of this kind of like oddball detective-y person. And that when that works, you know, people kind of become willing to corroborate that and to do these sorts of things. To embark on these missions, they shift from demand to desire and all that. So anyways, I just kind of wanted to kind of kick that back your way and see if you had any thoughts on that, because I do think it's important to think about the ways that these things can impact clinical work as well as the way that we read pop culture and other cool things.
Yeah, no, sure. I mean, that's the whole point of us doing this here, right? I've been in a couple of different kinds of therapy, including analysis, and I've had two very distinct experiences in each of them. And the funny thing is that from the way that I recollect my experience in other kinds, I mean, I was in CBT and DBT. I think those were the two main forms of therapy, like cognitive behavioral therapy and dialectical behavioral therapy, if you don't know the shorthand. And the main difference between those two experiences and entering analysis that I've noticed is that they don't, not only do they not allow you to switch from demand to desire, I don't think that that's what they want at all. I think they're looking for something. Well, first of all, they're looking for something in the first place, which is, I think, problematic in the therapy relationship in the first place. But aside from that, what they're looking for is somebody who comes in and does look at the therapist as having something to impart upon the person coming to therapy. They want people to come in and look at them as an expert who has some sort of tools that they can teach to their patients, and then their patients can go on and recreate as they go throughout their day-to-day lives. And that is not the experience that I've had in analysis at all. It's been a vastly different, my analyst like makes me, I can't even think of the right way to put it, but just makes me feel I do what I'm doing right now all the time. I completely lose my place and I'm like, oh shit, you're right. I do that and it doesn't make any sense. It's kind of stupid that I do it that way. And I had never had that experience before in any other kind of therapy.
I mean, when you say it like that, I think that, again, I've gone through forms of therapy and through it. I'm still doing analysis now. I'm probably going to do it. If I can, I'm going to do it for as much of my life as I can. And in therapy, I think a lot of therapists are trying to sort of evacuate the weird, evacuate the eerie.
Mm.
You know, like, let's cover that back over. Like that's there. Let's put something over it and sort of like make it as if it's not. Let's patch the hole in a sense and take those things maybe out of your life. Where in analysis, it's that isn't the case, right? Instead of trying to patch the crack or put it something over it, the project is this, well, how'd that get there?
Right. Let's look at it. Let's wonder what it is, where it came from.
And here's the another key difference, I think. The therapist might assume that they have the ability to cover over the crack or whatever. I don't think the analyst believes they can. Maybe they could, but that's not the point, right? They kind of the therapist gives something to, or I think they attempt to give something to the patient. They attempt to give the patient coping. They attempt to give the patient tools for their toolbox, whatever that means. They attempt to provide the patient with a service of some sort. Mm-hmm. I have something. I will give you what I have. Maybe you could even just use the basic idea of advice. I will give you advice and my advice will be useful if you follow it. Where the analyst says, I don't have that. You know, I don't have the answer. I don't know what that's mm-hmm. doing there. I don't know how it got there. I don't know what you're going to do about it. It's a good question, man.
Yeah.
That's interesting. What do you think? I'm just, and they do that because they don't have the answer.
Right.
They don't, I mean, which isn't, and I want to be clear about this. Like when an analyst is performing their function, of course they have ideas about why people are doing what they're doing. Of course they have ideas of ways that you might behave differently. And at times they could suggest those things to a person. I think that's possible, but they don't do that. Because instead they're more interested in the mysteries right. that are way more fun than answers. Mysteries
Absolutely.
Are interesting. You know, answers are different. This is the difference again between, I think, rules and principles, right? Mm-hmm. Rules come with a demand. They are an answer. Do it this way. And principles are mysteries. They're things where people can say like, you know, here's a one way we might look at it. What do you think? And it's open-ended in that way. And I would argue that has much more clinical significance, but it takes a longer time to use those things as well.
Yeah, for sure. I like that. This is all good stuff, Neil. Loving it.
Well, I think we should cut there then. I'm going to scan the podcast
Absolutely.
On that note.
I'm going to let you do it this time because I do it every time.
All right, cool. Well, today was my turn, right? So this has been the Inform Podcast, episode number 25. Thank you, everybody, for taking the time to download this and listen to it. And tell your friends and your family and random people. You know, people don't really encounter random people anymore, do they, in the land of coronavirus? Tell people about the podcast.
Hold a sign up.
Yeah. You know,
as you walk.
Yeah, that would be appreciated. And, until the next time we're in your ears, I hope that you can find some desire and some mystery and things that provide weird and eerie things in your life in ways that motivate you to be interested in why they're there.
Sounds good.